now anaesthetised and unconscious, was wheeled into theatre with a little entourage of two anaesthetists, two porters and UNOC, the ODA, pulling drip stands and monitoring equipment along with a tangle of tubes and cables trailing behind the trolley. His face was now hidden by broad swathes of sticking plaster, protecting his eyes and keeping the anaesthetic gas tubing and facial muscle monitoring wires in position. This metamorphosis from person to object is matched by a similar change in my state of mind. The dread has gone and has been replaced by fierce and happy concentration. As the tumour was at the base of the man's brain, and as there was the risk of heavy blood loss, I had decided to carry out the operation in what is called, simply enough, the sitting position. The unconscious patient's head is attached to the pin headrest, which in turn is connected to a shiny metal scaffold attached to the operating table. The table is then split and the top half hinged upwards so that the patient is sitting bolt upright. This helps reduce blood loss during surgery and also improves access to the tumour, but involves a small risk of anaesthetic disaster as the venous blood pressure in the patient's head in the sitting position is below atmospheric room pressure. If the surgeon tears a major vein, air can be sucked into the heart with potentially terrible consequences. As with all operating, it is a question of balancing risks, sophisticated technology, experience, skill and luck. With the anaesthetists, the theatre porters and UNOC, Fiona and I positioned the patient. It took half an hour to make sure his unconscious form was upright, with his head bent forward, so that there were no pressure points on his arms or legs where pressure sores might develop, and that all the cables and wires and tubes connected to his body were free and not under tension. "Well, let's get on with it," I said. The operation went perfectly, with scarcely any blood loss at all. This type of tumour is the only time in brain tumour surgery that you have to remove the tumour en bloc, in a single piece, since if you enter the tumour, you will be instantly faced by torrential bleeding. With all other tumours in brain surgery, you gradually debulk it, sucking or cutting out the inside of it, collapsing it in on itself, away from the brain, and thus minimising damage to the brain. With solid hemangioblastomas, however, you develop the plane between the tumour and the brain, creating a narrow crevice a few millimetres wide by gently holding the brain away from the surface of the tumour. You coagulate and divide the many blood vessels that cross from the brain to the tumour's surface, trying not to damage the brain in the process. All this is done with a microscope under relatively high magnification. Although the blood vessels are tiny, they can bleed prodigiously. One quarter of the blood pumped every minute by the heart, after all, goes to the brain. Thought is an energy-intensive process. If all goes well, the tumour is eventually freed from the brain and the surgeon will lift the tumour out of the patient's head. "All out!" I shout triumphantly to the anaesthetist at the other end of the table. Wave the scruffy and bloody little tumour, no bigger than the end of my thumb, in the air at the end of a pair of dissecting forceps. It hardly looked worth all the effort and anxiety. With the day's operating finished, I went to see the patient on the recovery ward. He looked remarkably well and wide awake. His wife was beside him and they expressed their heartfelt gratitude. "Well, we were lucky," I said to them, though they probably thought this was false modesty on my part, which I suppose to an extent it was. As I left, dutifully splashing alcoholic hand gel on my hands on my way out, James, the registrar on call for emergencies, came looking for me. "I think you're the consultant on call today," he said. "Am I? Well, what have you got?" 46-year-old man with a right temporal clot with intraventricular extension in one of the local hospitals. looks like an underlying AVM GCS-5. He was talking when he was admitted. An AVM is an arteriovenous malformation, a congenital abnormality which consists of a mass of blood vessels that can, and often do, cause catastrophic hemorrhages. The GCS is the Glasgow Coma Scale, and a way of assessing a patient's conscious level. A score of 5 meant that the man was in coma and close to death. I asked him if he had seen the scan and if the patient was already on a ventilator. Yes, James replied. So I asked him what he wanted to do. He was one of the more senior trainees, and I knew that he could deal with this case himself. Get him up here quickly, he said. There's a bit of hydrocephalus, so I'd stick a wide bore drain in and then take out the clot, leaving the AVM alone. It's deep. Carry on, I said. He's potentially salvageable, so make sure they send him up the motorway pronto. You might point out to the local doctors that there's no point sending him if they don't do it quickly. Apparently they need to use the magic phrase time critical transfer with the ambulance service, and then they won't mess about. It's already done, James replied happily. Splendid, I said. Just get on with it. And I headed off downstairs to my office. I cycled home, stopping off at the supermarket to get some shopping. Catherine, the younger of my two daughters, was staying with me for a few days and was to cook supper. I had agreed to do the shopping. I joined a long queue of people at the checkout. And what did you do today? I felt like asking them, annoyed that an important neurosurgeon like myself should be kept waiting after such a triumphant day's work. But I then thought of how the value of my work as a doctor is measured solely in the value of other people's lives, and that included the people in front of me in the checkout queue. So I told myself off and resigned myself to waiting. Besides, I had to admit to myself that soon I will be old and retired, and then I will no longer count for much in the world. I might as well start getting used to it. While I was standing in the queue, my mobile phone went off. I experienced an immediate flash of alarm, instantly frightened that this would be my registrar calling to say that there was a problem with the brain tumour case. But instead, I heard an unfamiliar voice as I scattered my shopping over the counter while struggling to answer the phone. You're the consultant neurosurgeon on call. Emergency calls are usually all sent to the on-call registrar, so I answered warily. Yes, I said. I'm one of the A&E SHOs, said the voice self-importantly. My consultant has told me to ring you about a patient here. Your on-call registrar is not answering his bleep. I was immediately annoyed. If the case was so urgent, why didn't the A&E consultant ring me himself? There used to be a certain etiquette about ringing a colleague. I find that hard to believe, I said, as I tried to gather up the hot cross buns and clementines I had dropped. A&E were probably just trying to shift patients quickly to meet their target for waiting times. I was just speaking to him 10 minutes ago. The A&E SHO didn't seem to be listening. It's a 67-year-old man with an acute on chronic subdural, he began. I interrupted him and told him to ring Fiona, who was not on call, but I knew was still in the building, and then switched the phone off, giving an apologetic smile to the puzzled checkout girl. I left the supermarket feeling anxious. Perhaps the patient was desperately ill. Perhaps James had failed to answer his bleep. So I rang Fiona on her mobile. I explained the problem and said that I was worried that maybe just for once it really was an urgent referral and not just an attempt to get a patient out of A&E. I went home,